chapter 21. Now we have the burden of the sea, the deserts of the sea. There are three burdens in this chapter, by the way. These prophecies are concerning Babylon, Edom, verse 11, and Arabia in verse 13. In verse 1, Babylon is called the desert of the sea. And that's what it looked like, a sea of desert. Jeremiah tells of their destruction, and in Jeremiah 50, verse 38, tells of their destruction. A drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up, for it is the land of graven images, and they are mad upon their idols. So because of idolatry, this is all dried up. And then another one in Jeremiah 51, verse 13. O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasure, thine end is come, and the message of thy covetousness. Then in verse 30 of the same chapter, he says, therefore thus saith the Lord, behold, I will plead thy cause, and take vengeance upon thee, and will dry up her sea, and make her springs dry up. Now, when we have the word sea here has a thought of bodies of water, and even the river Euphrates is called a sea, especially when it is overflowing. And so all of this would be dried up. Well, this happened in a measure when the Medes and the Persians came down against Nebuchadnezzar. They changed the course of the river Euphrates that run right through the city of Babylon, and they went in on dry ground, so right under the wall. So this was just a picture of what God's going to do in the end time, though. In verse 55 of Jeremiah 51, it says, because the Lord hath spoiled Babylon and destroyed out of her the great voice when her waves do roar. There was a time that happened, like the great waters. A noise of their voice is uttered. So Babylon would reign over Judah for 70 years. That was God's prophecy concerning how long Judah would be in under Babylonish captivity. And he definitely spells it out there as 70 years. There was more than 20 kings under Babylon's authority. But again, in Jeremiah 25, in verse 19, I believe it is, he talks about the Medes and the Persians coming all the way down through. I don't know how many verses I covered now. About down to verse 26. And the coming of the Medes and the Persians to take over this. In verse 2 of our lesson, a grievous vision is declared unto me. The treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously, and the spoil spoileth. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media. All the signs thereof have I made to cease. The vision was a grievous vision to Isaiah. It was a terrible thing. And his people would come into this place, and it'd be 70 hard, terrible years of tribulation had come upon them. But there was a time to come when the Persians would open the door for Judah to return home. Now this was prophesied in Jeremiah 50 verse 8, that God would let Judah return home after their 70 years of captivity. So it was a grievous vision. The Babylonians and the Chaldeans were grievous dealers, and they dealt treacherously. But God says, oh, go up, O Elam. Now Elam is the same today as we know as Iran. That area in there. And we wonder whether our God is going to use Iran again to bring Israel into the place that he wants them to be. They're a mighty powerful nation right now, more than they've ever been since the Alexander the Great's time. But God's doing a work there that we don't understand. But he uses little bitty nation of Elam, or the Medes, in that. Now they're known as Iran, and he's going to, in Isaiah 58, we read that 50, verse 8, it says that he remove out of the midst of Babylon and go forth in the land of Chaldea and be as the goats before the flock. Now, again, I say Babylon represents both religious and political forces in the end time. And it grew all the Gentile world powers. And we see this in the image that Nebuchadnezzar built in Daniel 2. Of all the powers, he is a representative. God says, you are this head of gold. And we'll see it again happen about 2,600 years later after Babylon conquered, went in and took over Judah. Today we're living about 2,600 years later, and we're seeing the revival of this Roman Empire coming force again, and God is going to fulfill the remainder of these prophecies that he hadn't fulfilled before. There's going to be a revival of this world system. In we read a while ago that Babylon, well, we didn't read it, I just talked about it, didn't I? But in Jeremiah 51, 7 and 8, read that Babylon has been a golden cup in the hands of the Lord. It was a cup for God to use. He's called my battle axe in one place in Jeremiah, my battle axe. So God used Nebuchadnezzar, and was Nebuchadnezzar a godly man? No, he wasn't. He was very ungodly. He was a hard man. He treated them mean, but God used him to bring them to the place that he wanted them to be. It's the same way where Cyrus, his name was mentioned before he was ever born in the scriptures in Jeremiah. He says, Cyrus is my man. Well, many years later, God used a man by the name of Cyrus to let the children of Israel go back and read Ezra chapter 1 and 2. How God used Cyrus. So God uses what he has to do what he wants. And just remember this, that God has a sovereign right to do what he wants when he wants to, just because he's God and we have no right to question it. We're just little pusillanimous people of the dust, and we have no right to question what God does in this world. So don't ever forget that. Verses 3 and 4, therefore, are my loins filled with pain? Pangs have taken hold upon me as the pangs of a woman that travaileth. I was bowed down at the hearing of it. I was dismayed at the seeing of it. Now this is parenthetical, is verses 3 and 4. And this tells us how Isaiah felt concerning Babylon's downfall. He was a type of Judah in tribulation. Now, Micah gives us some information on this in chapter 4, verses 9 through 11. Tells us what Isaiah is talking about. He said, now why dost thou cry out loud? Well, why did you? Is there no king there? Is thy counselor perished? For pangs have taken thee as a woman in travail. The pain in the pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and thou shalt dwell in the fields, and thou shalt go into Babylon, and there shalt thou be delivered. There the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemy. And God is going to do this again. He's going to bring them back. He calls this the night of my pleasure. When God defeats all of these nations that will come down against his people to annihilate them, that'll be their purpose for coming down there. But God is not going to let it happen. And the reason for all their troubles is because they trust in the nations rather than God. And God doesn't want us to trust in things, people, nothing except him. In verse 5, he said, prepare the table. Watch in the watchtower, eat, drink, rise, ye princes, and anoint the shield. Now this is to Babylon, and this was the condition of Babylon when the Medes and the Persians attacked it. It's all recorded there in the fifth chapter of Daniel, where Belshazzar, he was eating and drinking wine, and was making merry and having all this big time, and a handwriting came on the wall. He said, this is it. And It was a time for a change. This is about 100 years after Isaiah wrote this, by the way. You think God answers his word? He wrote it here in Isaiah, and 100 years later it happened. He always honors his word. In verse 6, For thus hath the Lord said unto me, Go set a watchman, let him declare what he seeth. And he saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, and a chariot with of asses, and a chariot of camels. And he hearkened diligently with much heed. And he cried, A lion, my lord, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime, and I am set in my ward whole nights. And behold, here cometh a chariot of men, and a couple of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods he hath broken to the ground. O my threshing, and the corn of my floor, that which I have heard of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, have I declared unto thee. Now this is to Israel a type, in this that we read here, Israel is a type of the last day remnant of Israel, and we could compare this with Habakkuk chapter 2. Read the first two verses of Habakkuk 2. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower, and I will watch to see what he will say unto me, and what I shall answer when I am reproved. And the Lord answered me and said, Write the vision and make it plain upon the table, that he may run that readeth it. And we know that the job of a watchman is to be on the alert and be able to tell what he sees. In our lesson in verse 7, he saw three chariots. The first one was drawn by horses, and the next one was drawn by asses, and the third one was by camels. Now, horses are the fastest, but the asses are more sure-footed, while the camels can go a long time without food or water. They're best for warfare, and whatever it takes to conquer Babylon, it was all there. In verse 8, we read as a watchman, and as he looked and cried, he cried, It's a lion. Now Babylon is called a lion in Daniel 7, and that's what he sees, a lion. A watchman representing Babylon as not seeing the real danger. The watchman was so taken with the sight, he could not leave his post until Babylon had fallen and her idols broken and made absolutely nothing. In verse 9, we saw something different. He saw only one chariot and a couple of horsemen. Now, who would fear such a few? Absolutely no one. Well, here comes a chariot and a couple of horsemen. So what? We're not afraid of them. But then it happened, and Babylon fell. And so it is in Revelation 18, at the fall of Babylon the Great, that's yet to come. And all of her graven images, all her religious, political systems that she set forth, the false church will fall, just like Babylon fell, with very little force. They conquered it without any trouble. And then in verse 10, we read how God speaks to Israel and calls her my threshing, my corn floor. It's his floor. It's his floor. The word corn here is a Hebrew ben or bane. And the best rendering of that word corn would be a builder, usually rendered son in the Bible most of the time. But it speaks of the tossing and removing of the chaff by their bondage. And God sees them as corn builder, strong bodied, and he's going to lift them up. Now in verse 11, we have a different burden. We have the burden of Duma. The word Duma means silence. And this is what God has worked in Edom by the tribulation. Now we've had the judgment of Babylon. Now we're going to change to a new judgment. The burden of Duma are in Edomites. And God's going to judge them by the tribulation, by sorrow, just like he did the other. These are descendants of Esau, the brother of Jacob. They sold his inheritance for a mess of pottage. And oh, there's, There's a lot of God's people are selling their inheritance today for a bowl of beans. And I feel sorry for them, just like Esau did. We read in Genesis 32 that Jacob sent a messenger before him to Esau and his brother in the land of Seir. This is in the country of Edom. And so the Edomites and the Esauites and all of these are the same thing. Duma is simply another name for them. In verse 12, the watchman said, "Morning cometh." Yeah, verse 12. "The watchman saith, the morning cometh, and also the night. If you will inquire ye, return and come." Now, the answer comes. There will be a morning, the breaking of the morning for Israel, but it's going to be nighttime for the remains of Edom. And what they need to do is inquire the Lord, to repent, to turn around, to head the other direction, to come to Jehovah with a whole heart, and God would take care of them. I would remove the burden from them. And now in verse 13, now we have another burden. And this is a burden of Arabia. "In the forest in Arabia shall ye lodge, O ye traveling companies of Dedanim." These are Ishmaelites that we're talking about now in verse 13, judgment upon them. And in 2 Chronicles 1, we have the genealogy of Ishmael, and I think it's number 7, I believe, Duma is one of his sons listed there. I'm not going to turn to it. And then he had a son by the name of Tema, which we're going to talk about in these verses. So let's remember those two sons are sons of Ishmael, which was the Abraham's son through Hagar. All right, so there are 12 of these sons altogether that Ishmael had. And then we have another thought of this in Ezekiel 27 that identifies Arabia with Dedam. We might look at that real quick. Ezekiel 27, along the same thought, verse 19. Says, "Dan also and Javan, going to and fro, occupied the fairs, brought iron, cassia, calamus." "Dedan was thy merchant and precious clothes for chariots. Arabia and all the princes of Kedar, they occupied with their lambs and their ram and the goats, in these were thy merchants." And then we talk about Sheba and Rama, which we'll look at this later on. I need to kind of stick something in that place because I want to talk about these others at another time. But we identify now Arabia with Dedan and Kedar. These are places that will be judged together. Arabia means mixed up or dusky mixed with light is a thought. Dedanim, which we had here, their name means their love, their moving, their proceeding, going forth. And these were now, the Dedanim were descendants of Ham through Cush. We read this in Genesis, this genealogy in Genesis 10, verse 7. And if you want to compare this genealogy, look in 1 Chronicles 1, about verse 9, of the sons of Cush, and it names their names. The sons of Raama, which we had, is Shema and Dedan. And then if we compare that, well, let's turn over there. Let's go ahead and do that. Let's take the time to do that. I think it's be profitable. In 1 Chronicles chapter 1, we have a genealogy, and notice the names of them in verse 9. And these are the sons of Cush. Now, Cush was the son of Ham, which was the son of Noah. And so we have the names of these, and you might make note of the sons of Cush. One of them named, let's see, it'd be number 1, 2, 3, 4. His fourth son was Raama. And then we have the sons of Raama, Sheba and Dedan. Now, these are some that are mentioned in this prophecy that we're studying tonight. And now, let's drop on down to the 32nd verse of the same chapter. And it says, now the sons of Keturah. So we're having a different family here, aren't we? Sons of Keturah. That's Abraham's concubine, or Abraham's he took her to wife after Sarah had died. And she bare Zimran, Jokshan, and Midian, Ishbak, Shushan, and the sons of Jokshan is Sheba and Dedan. So we have two different families here, it looks like, who had the same two sons, Sheba and Dedan. So it seems to me like these are two different people who had sons by the same name. Now, Wycliffe's Bible Dictionary thinks that these two families were intermarried. And as I've meditated on this and thought about this, it's just hard to think that this is true because they had different fathers. They couldn't have been remarried. One of the fathers was Ramah and the other one was Jokshan. So I lean toward the fact that the ones we're talking about in our lesson here is descendants of Abraham. This is November the 19th, 2004. We're studying in the 21st chapter of Isaiah, and we're on verse 13 tonight. And my name is Arthur Eggers. Let's just start with reading verse 13. The burden upon Arabia. In the forest of Arabia shall ye lodge, ye, O ye traveling company of Dedanim. The inhabitants of the land of Tema brought water to him that was thirsty, and they prevented with their bread him that fed. Now, God is speaking to the descendants of Ishmael now in this, and we read in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, genealogies of that, and in verse 13 we have the genealogy, verse 29 and 31, we have the genealogies of Ishmael. And I just want to pick up on two of them, but one of them is Duma and Tema. And this is along with our lesson. There are 12 sons. Ishmael had 12 sons. And in Ezekiel chapter 27, verses 19 through 21, Ezekiel identifies Arabia with Dedan and Kedar. Well, Kedar was the son of Ishmael, according to First Chronicles 1. Actually, he was second born. Kedar was a second born of Ishmael. But Ezekiel identifies Arabia with Dedan, both Dedan and Kedar. So Arabia means mixed up, or dusty, like half daytime and half night. Dedan, Dedanium, rather, is in our lesson, means their love, their moving, their proceeding on. They were descendants of Ham, Arabia was, through Cush. Now, in the genealogies in Genesis 10:7, we read the genealogies of Ham. And if we compare those genealogies with the genealogies of 1 Chronicles 1, we see there in verse 9, at the sons of Cush is Seba, Havilah, Sabta, and Re'amah, and Sabtecha. Now, then we read that the sons of Re'amah is Seba and Dedan. So, when we compare with 1 Chronicles 132, we see the sons of Keturah, Abraham's concubine, bear these same sons. So it seems to me, as I read this, and you can contradict me if you want to, but it seems to me that these are two different people who had sons by the same name. Although I was reading in Wycliffe's Bible Dictionary, and he thinks there is some intermarriage here of these. And to me, it's hard to think because they had different fathers. Ramah and Jokshan were different. Anyway, I lean toward myself toward it is Abraham and Keturah's son, of Genesis 25. So anyway, whoever it was, the land was and is much larger than its neighbors. Mostly desert, Arabia is. Some good land there. Many of the Arabians were nomadic people that just kind of wandered in the desert. But we read of the word here in verse 13, companies. Where was I just reading that? Yeah, in verse 13. O you traveling companies of Dedanim. The word companies here could also be translated merchants with caravans of Dedanim. Now they were of the same caravan. And so I think this is one of the reasons that these names are kind of mixed up, is because sometimes the sons of Ishmael and the sons of Ham and others travel together in these caravans, mainly because of the danger of making a long trip. So I see here that they are probably the same caravan, but different people in the caravan. In Genesis 37, we all know the story of Joseph and how his brothers put him in a pit and then brought him out. And I think we read there that they sat down to eat bread and they looked down the road and they saw a company of Ishmaelites, it says there, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spices and things, and they were going down to Egypt. And so they had to pass through there. In verse 14, we read of Teman, and he is the ninth son of Ishmael. And they will help what they can with food and water as they flee from the coming Medes, the army of the Medes and the Persians, I should say. And they'll be more merciful than others of Edom. And in the last days, will actually help God's people. Then in verse 15, for they fled from the sword, from the drawn sword, and from the bent bow, and from the grievous war. So let's read on down through 17, I guess. Let's go ahead and finish the chapter. For thus hath the Lord said unto me, wherewith a year, within a year, according to the year of a hireling, and all the glory of Kedar shall fail, and the residue of the number of archers, the mighty men, the children of Kedar, shall be diminished, for the Lord God of Israel hath spoken it. So God talks and sets up a time here, and he said within a year. What year is that? Well, he says the year of a hireling. What is a year of a hireling? Well, we had in chapter 16, when we talk in verse 14, we talk about the Moabs, and so the same thing will be with the Arabian, a part of Edom, an exact time. Now, it doesn't tell that time, it says that God's appointed time, God's exact time. That's the time of a hireling. When you hire someone to do a job for you, we expect them to start on time and quit on time, don't we? All right, so this is a time of a hireling, is God's appointed time when these things are going to happen. You don't allow a hireling to leave early, and so it will be with God's judgment. It's going to be right on time. And what is left of the archers, it won't do much good. There won't be much help there at all. It'll all be in vain. All right, let's go right on into the next chapter, 22. And here we have a burden of the Valley of Visions. Now this chapter tells us of a condition of Jerusalem, not Samaria, as some people suggest. The question here is, why is it called the Valley of Vision? Jerusalem is on a mountain and is almost surrounded by valleys. If we read in Psalms 125, verse 2, read, as the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so the Lord is round about his people from henceforth, even forever. It is God's chosen place, Jerusalem is. And all the visions that we have either center around Jerusalem or have something to do with Jerusalem, because this is his city. It's called the City of David. And so around about his people that are in Jerusalem is the thought. He must get their attention in order to draw them to himself. He wants them back in fellowship with him. And so all the visions that we have either has something to do with or directly concerning Jerusalem. So that's why it's called the Valley of Visions. This has three fulfillments. The first fulfillment is past in Isaiah's time when Hezekiah reigned and Sennacherib's army came down and all of his allies with him, and they tried to take over Jerusalem and Judah, and that was about 700 BC. And you could read the story, it's found in 2 Kings 18, and go start from about verse 13 and go through 1937. There's a story how God came and protected. Hezekiah sought the Lord, and we read that story too in the 19th chapter, which we already had, of Isaiah, first two verses, and then verses 14 through 19. And then God's answer is in chapter 19, 20 through 37. So here was one time of trouble. Then a second fulfillment of this is at a later time in 2 Kings 24, and read first 20 verses of that. We'll tell you the story. But this is when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came against Jerusalem, and his purpose was to destroy it. But there were three sieges before he could take the city. He took it three different times, but the last time he burned it. And we can read of these three times in verses, we're talking about 2 Kings 24, verses 1 through 11 is the first siege. Then on down in 25, chapter 25, the first 21 verses is the second siege. And then in 2 Kings, let's see, what's the third one? Let's see. I don't know, but you can find them in there in Kings. I forgot where the third one is, really. That's when they burned tore down the walls and burned the temple. But then there's one more time now. And the third one is in the last days. This is future, when God will bring all nations against Jerusalem again in the same valley we're talking about. They will cry and God will help them again. We've read several times in our studies in Joel chapter 3, and so you can reread it when you get home in the first 14 verses. But in verse 2, this same valley is called the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and in verse 14, it's called the Valley of Decision. And he says, multitudes, multitudes in the Valley of Decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the Valley of Decision. We're talking about the same area that are going to come down and completely surround Jerusalem in all the valleys that's around them. Verses 1 through 4 in our lesson begins with a question concerning the Jews' attitude. And he says, what ails thee now, thou art wholly gone up to the housetop? In other words, he's saying, what's wrong with you? As though they had the same attitude before. Why do you go to your housetop? Well, the reason they went to the housetop is because it was a place of rest and relaxation. And remember the story in Peter, first in Acts 10, where he saw the vision on the housetop. But he went up there to relax before dinner, and God gave him a vision. A lot of people went up on the housetop for this purpose. It was nice and sunny, and they could lay up there and kind of take it easy for a while and relax. So why are you up here relaxing? We could ask ourselves that question. The housetop had other purposes too. One was they used it for idol worship. And so that would be another answer to the question, why were you up there? Were you worshiping up idols up there? Or were you having a conference? Sometimes they gathered up there for a conference. We find this in 2 Samuel 9, 25, 26. says that when they were come down from the high place into the city, Samuel communed with Saul upon the housetop. So it was just a place of good conversation too. And then it says, and they rose early, and it came to pass about the spring of the day that Samuel called unto Saul to the housetop, saying, up, and I may send thee away. And Saul rose, and they went both of them, he and Saul, together. Another verse in 2 Samuel along this line, chapter 16, verse 22. And this is when Absalom tried to take the throne away from David. And we read there that Absalom spread his tent up on the housetop and went into his father's concubine up there to show everybody, I'm ruler now, I have my father's concubines. And so there were several purposes for going up on the housetop. We don't know what all of them were. But anyway, Peter went up on the housetop to pray. There's another verse in Zephaniah, chapter 1, verse 5. And it says, and them that worship the host of heaven up on the housetop. They go up there to worship the stars and the moon and sun and all these things, the host of heaven up on the housetop. And them that worship, and them and that swear by the Lord, that swear by Malcham. Now that Malcham was a false god of Moab and Ammon, and they called their king. So he says, "Why have you gone up on the housetop? Thou that art full of stirs in a troublous city, a joyous city. Thy slain men are not slain with a sword, nor dead in battle. Stirs and tremulous. I think we could translate that crying, noise, shouting. This has the thought of a riotous and exciting time, I guess. The enemy is pressing, and what will they do? Give in or trust the Lord? And so it's called a joyous city. And it should be a joyous city if they really trust the Lord, but they wasn't. If people die, it's not a war, neither by fear of natural causes. That's the thought that we have in that verse. And in verse 3, all thy rulers are fled to gather together, they are bound by the archer, all that are found in thee are bound together, which have fled from afar. This is the assembly of leaders from different areas who come, and they're bound by archers. Means that they are bent like a bow would be bent. They're bent to do their own will. And what an attitude to have. Have conferences that decide to ignore it, and it will go away. So that's what it is. They all get together and said, and I've heard people have that same attitude. Well, just ignore it and it'll go away. But that isn't always true, is it? In fact, it wasn't true at all in our lesson. They can't do that. Verse 4, therefore I said, I, look away from me. I will weep bitterly. Labor not to comfort me because of the spoiling of the daughters of my people. So Isaiah begins to weep. And this is not God weeping through, but it could be God weeping through him. He's also a type here of the remnant of Israel that will weep in the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. And this reminds us of Jesus when he wept. And he said there in Luke 19, he said, oh, Jerusalem, if you just had known, even now, at least in this thy day, the things which belong to thy parcel. But now they're hid from your eyes. You can't see them anymore. The days will come upon you that thine enemies shall cast a trench about you and compass you round about and keep you from every side and shall lay thee even to the ground and thy children within you. And they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knowest not the day of visitation. And then again, Jesus wept over his people in Matthew 23:37. and all of us know this story, but he cried out, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem." So that was his city. "That thou killest the prophets and stone them which are sent unto thee. How often would I have gathered thee, thy children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not." Isn't that a sad thing? "And you would not." So the remnant, in our lesson, the remnant before the kingdom, they cannot be comforted. There's nothing there. And I think the reason that they can't be comforted is because the nations are stealing God's things willingly. Does God not take joy in spanking his children? And the answer to that is definitely not, any more than you would, but it has to be done. In verse 5, "It is a day of trouble, and the treading down of the perplexity by the Lord God of hosts in the valley of vision, breaking down the walls and crying to the mountains." So the day of trouble is coming for sure. Treading down and oppression on every side. And we read some more about this same thing in Luke 21, I think it's verse 24. It says, "And they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Now, we know that this scripture was not fulfilled in the time of Jesus, because he almost says the same thing there in Luke 21. It is yet to come today because it hasn't had its fulfillment. When will it be fulfilled? When the times of the Gentiles are over. And they're not over yet. How do we know they're not over? Because the Gentiles are still ruling the Jews. They haven't gone in, even though they're declared a nation, they're still under Gentile authority. And so we know this hasn't been fulfilled as of yet. In Revelation 11, the first two verses in there, says, "There was given me," or John, "a reed, unto a rod, like unto a rod. And the angel stood, saying, Arise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court that is without the temple leave out and measure it not. For it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall be tread underfoot 42 months. 3.5 years, it's the last 3.5 years that they'll be trodden underfoot. Now, he says, you measure the temple of God and the altar and the people that worship. Now, the only thing that a person's allowed to measure is what belongs to him. So this part was given to the Jews, and the court and the without the temple, he couldn't measure because this part was still given to the Gentiles. And so John, which represents, is a representative of the remnant, that he was limited to what he could measure. But at the end of 42 months, or the last 3.5 years, then that land, that a temple will be given to the Jews, and everything pertaining to Jerusalem will definitely be given to them. Verses 6 through 8, "And Elam bare the quiver with the chariots of men, and horsemen and Kir uncovered the shield. And it shall come to pass that thy choice valley shall be full of chariots, and the horsemen shall set themselves in array at the gate. And he discovereth the covering of Judah, and thou didst look in that day to the armor of the house of the forest." Elam is the same as Persia, and it's the same as Iraq is today. Kir is a city of in Moab. We read in Isaiah 15, the first verse, that they will join other nations against Jerusalem. The valley from Lebanon through Kidron, a valley that separates the east side of Jerusalem. It separates Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, and probably at the Sheep Gate or the East Gate that we're talking about. In verse 8, the walls and the mountains represent God's divine protection, for his city, Jerusalem, will be kept. And God's going to keep it away and take away. When they see their weakness, the weakest of the house of the wilderness, that's what we're talking about here, house of the wilderness, house of the forest, thy choicest valley shall be full of chariots, and the horsemen shall set themselves array at the gate. Now, when we think of this, we say, how close will God allow the enemy to come to Jerusalem at the last day? And it's going to be dangerously close. So close that they'll cry to God for help. And when they do, God will answer. Verses 9 through 11. Ye have seen also the breaches of the city of David, that they are many. And ye have gathered together the waters of the lower Tyre, and you have numbered the houses of Jerusalem, and the houses have you broken down to fortify the wall. You make also ditches between the two walls for the water of the old pool, but ye have not looked unto the maker thereof, neither had respect unto him that fashioned it long ago. There are four things that we see in these verses. And when we look at these, we see man's effort to try to fix things without God. And this is dangerous, saints. When we see a problem in our life and we try to fix it with our own puny, well, they had holes in the wall, didn't they? And this means that they didn't have the protection that they needed when there are holes in the wall. And in 2 Kings, verse 12, I'm going to read verses 4 and 5 in there. And it says, Jehoahaz said unto the priest, all the money of the dedicated things that is brought into the house of the Lord, even the money, every one that passes the account, the money that every man is set at, and all the money that cometh into any man's heart to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priest take it to them, every man of his acquaintance. Now here's what I want. And let them repair the breaches of the house, wheresoever any breach shall be found. They couldn't. And we read here in our verse that they didn't ask God about it. They're just going to do it themselves. And so they collected money and collected money and collected money. And you see the church is doing the same thing to try to do something to take, hey, I went to one church one time and they had four collections before the guy would preach. Anyway, God doesn't need our money, and he doesn't need anything that we have, but he uses it to his glory. But let them repair the breaches of the house wheresoever the breaches are found. Now, in Amos 9, verse 11, we have another thought along the same line. And it says, in that day when I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen down, and close up the breaches thereof, I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old. So who's a better builder of breaches, God or man? Isn't it better to let God build our breaches? Well, that doesn't mean that we don't do anything. It doesn't mean we sit down in a rocking chair and say, God, Lord, you patch all the holes in my life. No, he wants us to yield to him and walk in the Spirit so that these things will happen. But in Amos 9, he says, I'm going to do it all. And what was their part? To yield to him, trust him, and he had it taken care of it. The second thing we read in our verse is to take care of the water supply. Oh, we've got to do that now because we can't have the enemy cutting off our water supply. But we have a verse in 2 Chronicles 32, and I'm going to read the first four verses of 2 Chronicles 32. Also see in verses 30 through 32, but I'm not going to read down that far, I don't think. But water, I don't think I'll read any of it. You can read it yourself. But how important is water? I guess it's one of the most important things that we have. I guess it's greatest of man's needs is water, isn't it? Abraham dug many wells. Isaac dug many wells. Isaac uncovered a lot of Abraham's wells. But the thought we have in our lesson is to protect the water supply from the enemy. So what did they do? They dug tunnels between the two walls to bring water into the city. Now, this water was brought into an aqueduct down in the southern part where the Valley of Kidron and the Valley of Hanan come together. And they brought that this water down the wall and into, and they had a pool down there, and I can't think of the name of the pool. Salon. Isn't it the pool of Salon? I think it is. I'm almost sure it is. You can look it up for yourself. But anyway, they had a pool there, and they built all of this together, and they had everything that they needed, but they didn't seek the Lord. I think that's terrible. The third thing they had to do was to count the houses. And it put a mark on the houses, kind of like our census, I guess, around there, and find these houses. And the reason that this was done was to determine which house was to be destroyed in order to strengthen the wall. So they would find these houses and they'd destroy it, and they'd use the material of the house to patch, and I say patch, the holes in the wall. It didn't do any good. Then the fourth thing in our lesson was to make a reservoir between the first wall and the one Solomon built. We read of him building a wall in 1 Kings 9, verse 15. And this is the reason of the levy which King Solomon raised for to build the house of the Lord and of his own house in Milo and the wall of Jerusalem. So on the east side, it was kind of a double wall in which this aqueduct, I guess you call it, was brought down through. But we look at all this, and it was all work for nothing. Because when God said that they're going to come in, they're going to destroy the city, they're going to come in and destroy the city. And nothing they can do can happen. All was still, and will be shaken, and taken, and moved upon by Babylon. Oh, if they had just sought God, things would have been much different, wouldn't it? Just sought the Lord. And I see disrespect to God here. They might have sought their own idols, I don't know, but they didn't seek the Lord. They don't realize that God had all things in his hand to control all things. Oh, that we realize that there's nothing that he don't know about. All right, verse 12 and 13. And in that day did the Lord of God of hosts call to weeping and to mourning and to baldness and a grinding with the sackcloth, girding with the sackcloth. And behold, joy and gladness, slaying ox and killing the sheep and eating the flesh and drinking the wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. There will be a call for repentance, of crying and humbleness, but not before the Lord. I think the joy in verse 13 is self-made joy. Joy on her own. Humbleness, but not before the Lord. Lack of hope. And notice the attitude there. Isn't that interesting? They just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. And Paul quotes from this at 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32, and he said, after the manner of men, I fought the beast in Ephesus. What advantage it to me if the dead rise not? Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. And tomorrow many will die. And tomorrow many did die in a time that we're reading about. There has to be a hope, and it has to be in God. God is the only hope. We could have the same attitude if we don't have a hope in him. In God's due time, he'll turn their sorrows, though, into joy. In Isaiah 51, and we sing this song in our course book, therefore shall the redeemed of the Lord shall return and come with singing into Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their head, and they shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and mourning shall flee away. So there will be a time of real joy. When we read of wine, you're really talking about a false joy, usually. In verses 15 through 25, let's just finish the chapter. This is another section. Thus saith the Lord God of hosts, go, get thee into the treasure, even into Sebna, which is over the house, and say, what hast thou here, and whom hast thou there? and thou hast hewn thee out a sepulchre here, as he that heweth out a sepulchre on high, and the great, and giveth an habitation for himself in a rock. Behold, the Lord will carry thee away with a mighty captivity, and will surely cover thee. And he will surely violently turn and toss thee like a ball into a large country. There shall thou die, and there shall the chariots of thy glory shall be the shame of thy Lord's house. And I will drive thee from the station, and from thy state shall he pull thee down. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with thy robe, and strengthen him with thy girdle, and I will commit thy government unto his hand, and he shall be a father unto the inhabitants of Jerusalem and unto the house of Judah. And the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder, so shall he open, and none shall shut. He shall shut, and none shall open. And I will fasten him as a nail in the sure place, and he shall be as a for a glorious throne to his house, to his father's house. And they shall hang upon him all the glory of his father's house, the offspring of the issue, all vessels of small quantities, from the vessels of cup even into the vessels of faggot. And in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall the nail that is fastened in a sure place be removed, and be cut down, and fall, and the burden that was upon it shall be cut off, for the Lord hath spoken it. Now God again speaks to Isaiah to check on embezzlement. Shibna means who built. And that goes along with what we've been talking about. Who built? The scribe that records the money is who this is. And he hath built himself a sepulcher. Sounds like there's a lot of embezzlement here, doesn't it? The kind of heathen, the kind that the heathen would build in high places. It must have been a beautiful sepulcher. In this, he was a type of the Antichrist that will take God's things and use them for his own glory. Now, this attitude many people have today, because we read in 2 Timothy 3, verses 2-5, it says, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, furious, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness and denying the power. Doesn't that describe Shibna? I think it does, but it describes in this time that we're living in right now. And so we have them. All right, let's take a break here. All right, verses 17 to 20 is the verdict of God upon these pretenders. Only Isaiah tells of his fate. God will turn and throw him like a ball into an open space. I don't fully understand this, but my mind goes thrown into open spaces a long ways. The glory that has been written on them will be shame. It'll be written on them. Another translation of this is, the Lord who covers thee with an excellent covering and clothes thee gorgeously shall surely violently turn and toss like a ball into a large country or a wide place. And that's just exactly what God did to these people. In verse 19, Sheba will be stripped from his high office and brought to nothing. So will the Antichrist when Jesus comes and throws him down as well. Then in verse 20, then another will take his place. And his name is Eliakim, which means God will establish, the son of Hilkiah. And his name means the portion of Jehovah. Now, this man is a type of Christ. He's true and faithful. He was over the household of the king. All at once was one Shimna, and now it's Eliakim. And I think this is a picture of the end of the tribulation, when all the honor Satan longs for will be given to Jesus. In verse 22, now and here we even more will be given to him, corresponding to Revelation 3, verse 7, where it says, "And to the angel of the church of Philadelphia write, these things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth and no man shutteth and no man openeth." You see, this is all talking about Christ will fulfill the covenant of David with all authority. And then in, remember, in the 9th chapter of Isaiah, verse 6, we read, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and a government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Almighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. So we have this similar to that in our verse here. Then in verse 23, I will fasten him as a nail. This reminds me of Ezra 9, 7 and 8, and which says, since the day of our father have we been in a great trespass unto this day, and for our iniquity have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered unto the hand of the kings of the land, to the sword, to captivity, and to spoil, and to confusion a face, as it is this day. And now for a little space grace hath been shown from the Lord our God, to leave us a remnant to escape, and to give us a nail in his holy place, that our God may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. So when God listens, is sure and unmovable, when he fastens these things together, so also in Christ. Verse 24, we read of the glory of his father's house will be seen. On are the offsprings and the issue, that is, that which comes out of children as vessels. And the other side of this was found in Romans 9, verse 23. And that you might make known the riches of his glory and the vessels of mercy which he had before prepared unto glory. So God is going to have vessels of mercy. Now this is a new creation that he will make Israel out of when Jesus takes charge of things. Of course, there'll only be a remnant. and then there's a verse in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. It says, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. So here's a treasure that God's going to put in the vessels. And then another one in 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 4. And he says that every one of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor. And then I think of another one in 2 Timothy, chapter 2, verse 20, and in every house there's vessels of gold and silver, also wood and earth, some honorable and some dishonor. But the thought here is, if a man therefore purge himself of these, he shall be a vessel in honor, sanctified and meet for the master's use, able to be used of the master, and prepared unto every good work. In verse 25, in that day, saith the Lord of hosts. So this is not the same nail, but a counterfeit nail. And this refers to Shimna, or the Antichrist in the last days. The nail gone, and the tent post, it was cut down and fallen. The load that was on it fell too. Now this tent, this nail, they had these center posts in the tent, and they would put these spikes in, and they were about a foot long, and they would hang all everything that they had on those nails. They were wooden pegs, actually, that they'd drive into the tent post. All their kitchen utensils, everything. They didn't have kitchen cabinets like we do today. Everything, all their clothes, everything that they had was hanging on these nails. But when the nails break, there was a loss of everything. It all fell. But when God puts a nail in, it doesn't fail, it doesn't fall, and everything is steadfast and sure in the house of the Lord.